later on in the night, the chairman came over to our table and rather than call me up on stage, he handed me this this silver tray. And Mr. Hillwood, he was ever so old Etonian, he went, young man, delighted that you gave an impact. You know, it was great. What position did you play? Michael Carruth had won the Olympic title. I suppose I celebrated a bit too much and I ended up with a pair of cut-off jeans on me in a really lush nightclub. I kind of went over to the goalkeeper, who was a young lad, the Salons keeper, and I said, Jesus, hard luck there. I'd say you'd have loved to have saved one of those penalties. And in beautiful Salons brogue, he went, piss off, you prick, you wouldn't take one against Spain. He didn't just bring a winning mentality into the dressing room, that united way. He brought it into the city of Sunderland. The whole city believed that this was the way forward for us, that what this man was saying, you know, he kind of swept into town and the whole city just backed him. He's number one and there's still a number one in him somewhere for him to do, to redo what he did at Sunderland. That was the end of my career. I never kicked a ball again. And I always said to myself, Jesus, one more kick. I should have took one more kick and I should have took a penalty. And that stayed with me for some time.
Hello and welcome along to a very, very special edition of the From the Horse's Mouth podcast. In keeping with our tradition, I hand you over to two of the greatest broadcasters of the modern era, Paddy Power and Ruby Walsh, in conversation with one of the greatest Irish footballers of the modern era, Mr. Niall Quinn.
Thanks very much, Tom. Niall, thank you very much for joining us in From the Horse's Mouth. It's great to have you on board.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we're looking at you here. We can see on the screen, it's kind of like a head and shoulders shot of you, the sun streaming in the window from Kildare. But there's only one place for me to start. I can only see your t-shirt now. Are you sat there chatting to us in your disco pants?
Oh, no, not quite. I can't believe you brought that up. I thought I'd buried that ghost a long time ago when I finished football, but it's hung around. And I know what you're referring to. It was one of those things where before, I suppose, social media and fans had ways of kind of latching onto a player. They caught me with a few points on me one night in pre-season. The manager let us out after 2 weeks. And Michael Carruth had won the world title that day. The Olympic title. And I ended up, a lot of funny things happened to me. I got a bit, I suppose, I celebrated a bit too much. And I ended up with a pair of cut-off jeans on me in a really lush nightclub. And the Man City fans that were there at the pre-season at the time, they followed me around and they took old-fashioned photographs of me, not the phone ones that we know. Appeared on a programme at the next, when we got back, and the next league game that we had. And so from that moment on, people started singing things at me about the disco fans. And I thought I got rid of it. Nobody's brought it up for years, but you brought it back up, Paddy.
Get in low and early. That's the way I've been brought up, you know, low and early. But to be honest, it is a bit of a shame that there was no smartphones back then. That's something that'll be hard. It sounds like it'd be harder to live down than your man Muller's fucking dancing in his lederhosen. But and it's mad that fans were away with you on pre-season and that, and it was all, you're kind of in with the fans and everything, and probably they were probably out drinking pints to the team and all kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was different times. You know, that particular trip, we were brought to the mountains in a place called Pinolo in northern Italy, and we did about 10 days serious training, and Peter Reid said, right, you can go off and enjoy yourself tonight, no curfew. And after 10 days of being locked up, that was just a crazy idea. And all sorts, I ended up, you know, I was so inspired by the Irish Olympic boxing champion, Michael Carruth, that day, that I ended up, for my troubles, I knocked out Steve McMahon in a row at 4 o'clock in the morning in the square in this beautiful picturesque village up the mountains. It was, and all of us like we're gone a bit loopy, but they were the times that was in it, you know, 8 hard days locked up in a detention center and then being told you can go and do what you want. It wasn't the best plan looking back.
But now, it was a chant that the City fans started with you, but it followed you all the way to Sunderland and they released it as a single.
I know, a group up in Sunderland released it for a single, and that was kind of, it got a bit silly then, you know, and there was people auctioning off these disco pants, signed disco pants that I was supposed to have signed for thousands of euro, and it kind of went out of hand. And you know, looking back, I suppose it was nice that fans kind of remember you for something, but I'd rather it was, you know, that was scoring great goals or playing good matches, you know. But yeah, the Sunderland ones really latched onto it as well. And you know, I'm told occasionally when fans were in the stadium, obviously they haven't been for some time, an odd bar that comes out if Sunderland are doing well. But again, not happening so much these days.
So then, how many copies did yourself and Gillian buy?
We were the opposite. We were trying to put a blanket over this. Nobody buy any. This is kind of an embarrassing thing that happened. But you know, at the same time, looking back, I suppose it was good that they had something to sing about.
It's funny you say, and you mentioned it there yourself, because you've done more than just inspire a musical generation. You've also scored a few goals. And the one that I want to start with, if you don't mind, is that goal against Holland in Italy 90 that put us through the knockout stages. I mean, that must be a moment where your life changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And funny enough, you know, with the 30th anniversary and lockdown, all the different programs that were on, you know, on RTE and Virgin Media over the months, occasionally, you know, some of the Ireland matches come on and I saw myself doing an interview after. So, oh my God, that's not me. You know, because I was there kind of going, I'm delighted to be in the first team, you know, and delighted to be scoring a goal for Ireland. And it's the greatest moment of my life. And, you know, I was kind of, oh my God, should we not have got education and lessons on how to do interviews in those days? At the same time, it was a hugely important goal for me. And I had two very important goals in my career. They were both very similar and both were mistakes from goalkeepers. One was my debut for Arsenal against the great Liverpool team, and Bruce Grobbelaar dropped one in similar circumstances. And it was my debut and I followed in the hope that he'd do it, and he did. And then the second one, Hans van Breukelen was the Dutch goalkeeper. Messy goal, but again, I followed in hoping he wouldn't save it properly. Why did I do that? Because Pat Rice was my youth team coach at Arsenal, and every day after training we would do finishing, and he made me follow in after every shot. He said, one day this will work for you. And it was actually two big days. And I ended up staying in the Arsenal team. Obviously, you score on your debut against Liverpool, you stay in and you become a player. And my international setup, that was the first competitive match I was ever picked to start. And I stayed in the team for 10 years afterwards. So there were two fairly important goals for a run-of-the-mill sort of hope or belief that the goalkeeper might drop one.
It's like there was yourself, John Aldridge, Tony Cascarino in that Irish team. And like, which two would Jack play? And then we're in against the Dutch. You scored a goal. Quinn the Eskimo is the song that went to it forevermore. Amen. But like that kind of announced Niall Quinn to the Irish fans. You were there, but all of a sudden you were a hero.
Yeah, well, I was a fringe player and I was out of the Arsenal team for nearly 3 years while I was stuck at Arsenal. It was only the March before the World Cup that I got playing first team football again in the top flight. And we were bottom of the table when I signed with 9 games to go, but we won a lot of matches and we ended up finishing 14th, I think. But I got a few goals, but I also scored a couple of goals against England B down in Cork. And that was a huge time for me because I played very well that day. And I kind of announced myself to Jack Charlton then that I was ready to get on the plane for the World Cup because I'd been scoring a few goals for City. And to beat England down in Turner's Cross in Cork, I saw highlights of it. Somebody got it up on their phone for me and showed me a few minutes of it. It was in the lashings of rain down in Cork. Playing against, you know, some very good England players and who went on to have great careers. And we trounced them. You know, I think it was 4-1 in the end. It could have been 10. And I remember going back up to the camp. I was asked to come back up to the first team camp then to make up the numbers to go on the bench for a friendly the next day. And all of the first team were rattled a little bit, or all of the guys, you know, the usual squad players were rattled by what, you know, three or four of us had done. And by the time, you know, a couple of months later, he announced the World Cup squad, Alan McLaughlin got in very famously. Nobody, you know, had heard of him until he turned up at the airport, and very unfortunate for Gary Waddock, who had to leave from the airport after a week's friendly matches in Turkey. But, you know, by the time he got to the mainland for the World Cup in 1990, our bags arrived in Rome and Gary was called to one side and he was told he wasn't part of it. And Alan McLaughlin walked in the next door. It was unbelievable, really incredible time. But there was David Kelly as well as myself. So, you know, there was Dennis Irwin played that day and didn't make the squad. That will kind of tell you, Dennis was brilliant down in Cork, the best fullback I think we ever had. And he, you know, Jack didn't deem him, you know, good enough at that point to go to the World Cup. So it was just a pleasure to get there. But then obviously, you know, the way the games went and to get the goal against Holland, it was so you kind of wake up and wonder, did it all happen really, you know?
I can't believe it was that hard. Like that, you literally turn up on the way on the airports. You're listening, lads. Here's the tickets for all you know. You go this way. You go over there, Paddy. You're on the way home, you know?
That's Gary Waddock. That's exactly what happened. And I stayed in touch with Gary a little bit, spoke to him there. We had a reunion 18 months ago, and he still didn't feel it was appropriate for him to come back. Even though the reunion wasn't for 1990 only, it was for players who played around that time with Jack, you know, because, you know, Gary was around, you know, for some time before that, but and had played a lot under own hand, but he didn't feel comfortable coming over. So, you know, it was an amazing thing. And Alan then, you know, not so long after, I think 3 years later, Alan was our savior up in Belfast. You know, some amazing things happen. You know, one decision could change everything. At Gary Waddock's day, Alan McLaughlin might never have got in. You know, it's amazing stuff, really, when you look at how football ebbs and flows.
When Jack took over, Niall, you were sort of coming on the fringes or coming on the scene. Did he really call you a headless chicken when he first came across you?
Regularly.
Regularly. Good man, Jack. Cut straight to it.
Yeah, he'd stop the middle of chicken. Stop the middle of chain training, and he'd go, "What are you doing? You're running around like a headless chicken. Just stand still, you know." And I was, you know, taught to go for the ball, and you know, I was working on my touch, and I wanted to show off to him that I had a good touch. And he went, "You're not here for your touch. Get to the far post. Hold your ground." And when they win it, drop back in and be a fifth midfielder. So I had to make a line of five. Now, they do it today in a more sort of military fashion. It's all pretty good. But nowadays, it was unheard of. And I was going, "Hang on a second. We've got the ball. We're going forward. And I have to run back into midfield in case we lose it." And he went, "Yeah, and if you don't like it, go and play with some other country, you know." So it was, and I remember John Aldridge one time saying publicly, "We're going to anybody who plays up front for Ireland is going to turn their legs into tree stumps. We're running that much." And I remember Jack got the hump about it and bringing it up in a team meeting. And his answer to it was, "And John, now you've got to do it twice as much, or I won't pick you again." You know, so that was Jack's way. He was very, but at the same time, he was very rough and tumble about it. But he was also so adamant that it was going to be his way or the highway. And the way he changed how Ireland played her football from own hands time, John Giles originally to own hands time, to this new era that he brought in, which was really focused on making sure that teams didn't overrun us and that we stayed in the game and that if we got bits and pieces on it, we would be competitive. Now, you know, it was primitive, but I think it was primitive when we had the ball because we were very much a long ball team. But I think off the ball, we were doing everything that Klopp is asking his Liverpool players to do now in terms of making a wall, you know, when you haven't got the ball. And in terms of making sure that, you know, that the number 10 on the international teams of the opposition teams in them days used to always run the show against us. And there was always too much space and they would always have, you know, a great game against Ireland. So we just cut that out and made sure that with the work rate we had between the front, one of the front players at least dropping back, having five in midfield, that number 10 always had a wall in front of him that he hadn't got by and through us. And that was sort of been sort of ingrained into my mind. But his way of doing it was quite funny, really, when you look back at, "Oh, you headless chicken, run back here, you're running the wrong way," you know, and he'd shout and scream at me. And it took a while, and I think he said himself in an interview one time, Niall wasn't listening for a few years, but once he started listening and got the hang of it, he became a bit of a player. So he took all the credit for that, you know.
He had his way, but his ways worked, there was no doubt about that. Like, obviously, he ended up beating Romania, going out to Italy, but I read somewhere else and we were doing a bit of research. Did you end up in a restaurant with the Romanian keeper shortly after the penalty shootout?
Yeah, so I was exhausted. I'd played the 120 minutes and I was really, really exhausted after the match. And Dave O'Leary, he'd scored the penalty and the two of us were rooming together. You know, two months beforehand, neither of us thought we'd get there. Dave was trying to make it up with Jack. He'd had a bad start of life with Jack Charlton a few years earlier. And he was hoping to make the trip. I was hoping to make the trip. And suddenly we were in the center of it all that night, but we were exhausted. And Dave wouldn't be a fella to go out on the rip, you know, like some of the other lads wanted to do. And I would have normally, to be honest with you, but I was just so shattered. He said, "Why don't we just go for a meal? We'll sneak off and find a little Italian." And we did. And in that was the sad thing about it was, I don't think Romania had their revolution by then. The wall and all that was to fall down. It was an amazing time, really, European history. And the goalkeeper was in there with his wife, but he was also there with two soldiers sitting at the table. And the two soldiers were sent to mind him to make sure he didn't defect. But because he was captain and he was 30, he was quite early, he was 32 or 3 years of age, he was given the privilege of being allowed out of their compound to go for a meal with his wife. And we went over to sit with him, and it was an awkward start for a couple of minutes because of the soldiers' presence. You know, there were literally Romanian soldiers guarding him, eating his meal. And we kind of, it was an incredible situation. And we headed off, I headed off back to sign new contracts at clubs, et cetera. And him and his wife were heading back to the Romanian regime, which fell, was toppled a couple of years later. And I think he got 1 year at 37 years of age. I think he went off to Mallorca to play, and he got away. But yeah, it was a surreal sort of memory from what was a kind of a wonderful, joyous occasion. But that was that kind of level.
You forget how recent those events are. You think they're so far ago, but they're not. Like, massive history events like that are so recent. But like, that was the 1990 World Cup. You missed 94. Mm-hmm. Was that injury, or did City pull the plug on you?
I did my cruciate about a week after we qualified up in Belfast, that incredible game where we drew one all. Alan McLaughlin pulled it out of the fire for us, and we got through on goal difference. We beat Denmark to the World Cup, and Spain and ourselves from our group got there. And it was all excitement. Everything was great. I went back and played for Man City. And I think two games later, I did my cruciate, and I was in a rush to make the World Cup. It was 7 months away. And in them days, the player didn't have any power. You had to do what the club said. The club had full authority, and my club wouldn't let me even aim to get back for the World Cup. And I always felt Jack Charlton could have helped me a little bit more, because he was a teammate of Franny Lees, who was our chairman. And I was hoping he'd put pressure on Franny to come, because, you know, I felt that I was going to be okay. And I worked as if we were going to, or I was going to go, and Jack was going to pick me. I had it right up to the last minute, but it didn't come off. And when I got out there, I did some commentary for RTE and really enjoyed it. It was with Brendan O'Carroll for 4 weeks. I mean, he was bonkers, but we had a great time. I could give you 40 minutes on that trip alone with Brendan O'Carroll and the caper, a young Brendan O'Carroll. So you can imagine the capers we got up to. And that was fun, but I missed playing. And I also knew that, you know, when I looked at the matches, we weren't at it up front, because Tony Cascarino injured his calf just before the first game. Tommy Coyne came in and played when he could, but he was suffering. He had illness. And you know, John Aldridge was really only the fit striker. He got suspended at one point as the games went on. So it was a pity, because I felt I could have played. And the disappointing thing for me was I got back to England 4 days later, pre-season friendly, they played me. And I always held a bit of a grudge because of that. But that's because you're selfish and you're a player and you want the best. You imagine a doctor telling you can't do Cheltenham and you have a runny nose or something.
Didn't ask him.
Maybe that was my fault, yeah.
Didn't ask him. Did you ask Jack to have a word with the chairman?
I did.
Or did you assume he would?
Yeah, I did. I asked him straight out. I actually went to a dinner that I knew he was at, purely to ask him that, and he went, leave it with me. But that was it. It didn't go any further.
It's amazing though, Ethan, like to play in two World Cups is amazing, right? And it would have been three, but as an Irish player especially, to play in two, and you're like you said, they literally played you, City, like, and to miss out in three, but still to get two was amazing. Like, you were there in 2002 as well, and you set up the goal for Robbie Keane against Germany, and like, That was another, well, there's lots of memories of that tournament, I'm sure, for different reasons as well. But again, like, I mean, if you're going into your first game for Ireland way back when, to think that in 2002 you're going to be at a World Cup again is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I got on that trip to Iceland in 86 when a few players pulled out, and it was my international debut. We won a triangular tournament there against Czechoslovakia, as they were called there then, and Iceland, and it was a little bit of a victory. It was a turning point for Jack, because the first couple of games hadn't gone well, and a bit of a journey started. It didn't get going immediately, and a lot of people, you know, point to beating England, or that trip in Iceland maybe, and Jack coming in and beating England in 88. But he wasn't really well accepted at the beginning, Paddy. You know, and I was in even questioning what he was at in Iceland and how he was wanting us to play. And I knew, didn't know a lot about it. And some of the senior players were as well. And so we had to win them over. And it was a difficult time. But I think the day it all changed for us was actually a friendly in Lansdowne Road against Brazil. And I managed to get on the pitch for that. And we beat Brazil in Lansdowne Road, who had a top team over. You know, they their then stars. I think Romario made his debut that day for Brazil. And it was just, that was different, because then you were, I can remember clearly after that, walking around the streets of Dublin and the taxi drivers bipping and saying, well done. Whereas before that, they'd be going, you are brutal, you know, they'd be shouting out the window. So that was a turning point. And my career sort of turned in that phase. And then I got in for 1990, which was great. But, you know, to come back in 2002 and to be there, as you say, 16 years later, was probably, you know, especially when I had my second cruciate, because I did my other leg in around about 96. So I missed out on the Irish team twice, really. You know, I missed a World Cup in 94, and then I missed a full campaign with Mick when other players, younger players, came in and looked as if they were going to do better than me and that I wouldn't have a way back in. So that was in 96, 97. So to kick on five, six years after that, was I suppose, looking back, was an achievement.
When you look at that last game in Saipan against Spain, you played them off the pitch.
Yeah. Actually, there was no tournament in Saipan, Ruby.
Or Japan or wherever it was. Korea.
That we'd gone to Korea by that stage. We played Spain in Korea, in Seoul. And yeah, I think there was a early on in the game, you know, they were strutting as a Spanish team do, and we were kind of finding our way, and then started to believe in ourselves, and the game ebbed and flowed, and we should have really done it in extra time, particularly because they went down to 10 men, although the 11 stayed on the pitch. He couldn't do much, and we didn't take advantage of it, and we crowded ourselves out in an attempt to try and get the winning goal against 10 men, and we didn't get there. But then, of course, it went to penalties. And, you know, despite how well we played and the emotion of the performance, given the background that we were, you know, we were under the cosh a little bit, well, more than a little bit, we were under a huge amount of pressure because of what had happened in Saipan. And we had to give a good showing of ourselves. You know, I think that was important. If we flunked the first three matches and got beaten every game and came home, I think none of us, I certainly wouldn't be coming back to live in Ireland a couple of years later. I can assure you of that. That's how serious it was. And so we had to do well. And the disappointing thing is, when we got to a point where we started to really perform, we just didn't have the conviction to go over the line and take that game. And, you know, it wasn't for, I suppose, a fear or lack of ability. I don't think that was there. The young lads, you know, jumped, I want to take a penalty, let's go. We were on a kind of a surge that went, right, we're going to go to the next round of this, we're going to go to the quarterfinal, we're going to emulate the guys in 90. But sadly, the penalty shootout didn't go our way, and I personally would have a huge regret. That I was next up, I was taking the sixth penalty, had things gone okay, but when it didn't happen, that was the end of my career. I never kicked a ball again, and I always said to myself, Jesus, one more kick, I should have took one more kick, and I should have took a penalty, and that stayed with me for some time, you know.
And is it a cop-out to say the penalty shootout? Like, is it a toss of a coin, or is it for example, who should be favourites from a betting point of view? Or should Spain be favourites because they have more stars in the team, or is it literally better keeper or toss of a coin type of thing?
We might have been in the situation more often than us to deal with it, perhaps. We hadn't been in it since Romania 94, and the team had changed drastically in 8 years. You could look into it in many ways. You know, we took a lot of penalties. Some of the media said, Mick said something, we don't really practice the penalties. And it was a throwaway line, because we did. I got in goal for penalties every day after training. And I used to bet the lads that they wouldn't score three of them in a row. And it was an even money bet. The odds were completely stacked in my favour, because even if they got two, they would brick themselves on the last penalty, and you knew they'd hit it over the bar or they'd do something. And I was so big, my line was, well, I'll be big and jump and I'll guess right one of the three times. And I actually earned a fortune, but the feckers wouldn't pay me. So I have an outstanding debt notebook of penalties against me from the years of being in the Irish team. And so we did. So we took a lot of penalties before and after, and, you know, before and after training and stuff. But going back to your point, what would have been different? You know, had you drilled a certain way of taking a penalty into eight of us and trained it weeks in a row, would people have stood up to and I suppose, just repeated that and take it as natural? I don't think so. I think there's a lot at stake when people go up to take a penalty. And I took one in Wembley. My first one was in the playoff in a similar position at Wembley not long afterwards. Sorry, I don't see what the beforehand. Sorry, in about late 90s, I think. And I took a playoff penalty at 6-6. And it was a very lonely walk from the centre circle at 6-all. The winners get to the Premier League. I think they said it was a 25 million game in those days, probably a 250 million game nowadays. And I walked on my own and I juggled the ball down to the penalty spot, put the ball down, could hear the quietness, was pretty okay about it and made my way up to play. And I remember the goalkeeper, Sasha Illich, I saw him dive. He was that early to dive. I was able to just knock it near the corner and it was an easy penalty. And I walked back up and the crowd all cheered and I was looking at my teammates. And I never forget, something rushed down from my head right all the way down. It was like, I don't know what it was. It was like I was in a different moment until I took the penalty. And when I got back to the halfway line with the rest of the players, I was shaken. But thankfully, it didn't happen
after
before I took it. But that was there is a mental aspect to it, you know, a psychological aspect to it that needs to be thought of as well. And when you look back, you know, when England used to lose penalty shootouts and it was big news and people used to ask why, the precision of the Germans, you know, it was the psychology of the Germans, you know, when they would go up to take penalties in those days, that, you know, you thought they couldn't miss. And we were a bit slow at getting into that mode. We were kind of beginners in many
ways. But you add into that situation now, right? Roy had walked in Saipan, the pressure was on. To me, Roy's defection looked to spark something within the team. Would that be fair to say?
There certainly was a response. I would agree with that. We kind of, as a group, had to pull together and say, okay, we can all cop out of this and start blaming other people and play poorly and say it was it wasn't our fault, or we can go on and rescue the thing and really give the people something to talk about other than Saipan. And thankfully we did that. Now Saipan will never be forgotten and it's a huge story, but at least we were able to bring some pride into the situation that players showed, you know, what they were willing to do and give and fight for the cause. And I think that, you know, people say, oh, you know, players did it for Mick. Yeah, I did it for Mick and Roy had left. But truthfully, we were all doing it for ourselves. You know, soccer is a selfish game in many ways. And, you know, I think any sort of inkling there that, you know, we'll do this for Mick McCarthy and we'll do this for... You go into a very selfish place in a moment like that. And you become, you know, stubbornly willful in your desire that I'm going to play, or give me a chance, I'll show it. And we all got into that mood. Nobody bottled out of it. Nobody said, oh, I'm not happy. Oh, it's not right. Oh, things are tough. I don't like this pressure. Everybody went from Robbie Keane and Damien Duff, who were babies at the time, right the way through to the old ones like myself. You know, there was a belief that we could do things. And again, you know, I've said this many times, you know, the frustrating thing is, having gone to the penalty shootout, had we gone that step further, we were playing the hosts, North Korea, had we beaten Spain. And quite truthfully, with the game we played, we'd have had too much for them. I think we'd have gone further than the team in 90. I think we'd have beaten the hosts, who did beat Spain, but Spain were diminished. They had a lot of players injured. But, you know, you start, here I am, 54 years of age, still thinking we should have done this, we should have done that, you know.
It sounds like Korea haunted you an awful lot more than Saipan ever will.
Yes. Saipan, like, jumped out of all sort of proportions in terms of what media were thinking. We were asleep when people in Ireland were awake. There was two sort of narratives going on. It was a really tough time. All of us wanted it to be relieved, and say all of the players wanted to just, you know, be great if he came back. Come on, can we do something about it? I was kind of the oldest player, so I had to sort of do that kind of stuff on behalf of the players and try and link in. And so we try to do your thing, and you look back and you go, geez, it was all mad. And of course, you know, people are set firm in their beliefs. They believe, you know, things that happened maybe didn't happen at all. But, you know, ultimately it was a disastrous situation that all of us, you know, need to shoulder some responsibility for. And I mean everybody. You know, had we known it was going to be so serious in that team meeting, we should have just abandoned the team meeting. And the team meeting brought it off to a level that, you know, I hate even looking back on. But having said that, we kind of restored some bit of a pride of it, and at least we gave a more to the narrative that the tournament would be remembered for how we played as well. So, and I think whenever you see Robbie scoring his goal and his rather unathletic attempt to celebrate compared to some of the other players around the world, you know, and then, of course, I jumped on him and everything was fine. 7 or 8 of the other players jumped on him. And then big Richard Dunn, who wasn't the smallest footballer that ever lived, he jumped on the whole lot of us, and that was my back done. I was having ice on my back for about 2 days after that. But look, there's good memories in there, there's bad memories. And I was pleased in many ways when Roy eventually came to Sunderland as manager and did as well as he did. I was pleased that there was more to my relationship than somebody who was part of a group who supported Mick and played for Mick in that tournament, rather than saying it was Roy that we should have been sticking up for. It was just really difficult time for us, Ruby, and it doesn't get any easier. And I appreciate that it was 1,000 times more difficult for Roy Keane.
Here at Paddy Power, we want our gambling to be fun and encourage our customers to bet responsibly. That's why we offer a number of tools to help you stay in control, including the ability to set deposit limits, get reminders after a certain amount of time playing, and to take breaks. For more information, visit responsiblegaming.paddypower.com. 18+, begambleaware.org.
How did you get him to Sunderland? How did you fix the bond, fix the break, fix it, make up? How did you get over that?
Well, a man you'd know well, Sean Mulryan, was involved in our purchase of Sunderland, and Sean was great. And Sean set up a meeting for us all in his house, and Roy came in, and he was great. He came in and just said, "Look, Niall and I have a little bit of business to discuss. If you just give us a couple of minutes." Fair play to him. I was there thinking, "Jesus, lads, don't go too far." this didn't go well. But in fairness to him, professional as you could be, he said, "Okay, if we're doing this, put everything behind us, let's go." And that was it. It was literally 5 seconds. And we kicked on from there. And it took him a while. He didn't take the job straight afterwards. And he kind of went against taking it for a little while. And then he came back into it and took it. And it was just, it was an amazing year. That year when we got promotion, he took over, we were like, we won one game out of five. I was in charge. I remember it well.
Your brief stint as a manager.
Brief stint as manager was over. And he came in and just, I say this to anybody who cares to ask, he didn't just bring a winning mentality into the dressing room, that united way. He brought it into the city of Sunderland. The whole city believed that this was the way forward for us, that what this man was saying, you know, he was talking, you know, about bringing discipline into Sunderland players. You know, it sounds a little bit old fashioned now, but remember, it was, I suppose that's probably what, 15 years ago now. But he was talking about how players had been getting away with playing at this club half-cocked and not, you know, giving it their all. And he kind of swept into town, and the whole city just backed him accordingly. And the players responded. And we did what we could. We bought players to help him along the way. But it was great to see him in that first year, that first 18 months, 2 years, you know, obviously his most successful time as a manager. And to see the control he had over not just his players, but the club and the city as a whole. And I always felt, you know, that he was going to go on somewhere bigger and do it on his own. Now, he chose to go number two for the last lot of years, but I would always still argue, you know, the point that he's number one, and there's still a number one in him somewhere for him to do, to redo what he did at Sunderland.
Did he do it like I know he's performing now as a pundit and everything, but it's all very negative. Like, and you said, like, people getting away with it for years. So was he like that? Was it out of fear, or was he also kind of man managing behind it all and that kind of thing?
I think there was man management behind. He was getting reactions from people. I mean, he was getting the right reactions. He knew he had somebody who would go the extra yard with him. I think those who chucked the towel in early were the ones he was calling out. And, you know, some players found it strange because the world was beginning to change. You know, players weren't being coached, you know, in the environments that I would have started off in. You know, there were tough places to be plying your trade, and all of a sudden it was starting to become holistic, and you couldn't shout at players, and you know, that whole sort of change that came in the environment of football. And Roy was you know, was sort of from, I would say, if he would have one foot back the other way compared to, you know, sort of some of the certainly the coaching seminars that I see nowadays, and I see people talk about how to handle footballers nowadays, and they're thinking, "Oh my God, thank God I don't play these days." You know, like we had a coach, Bobby Saxton, and Bobby Saxton was at Sunderland. Peter Reid got all the credit, but all of the players know Bobby Saxton was hungry. Some of the stuff Bobby would come out with, you know, to get you to play better and to play well. He was a genius, but he did it an old-fashioned way, and he effed and jeffed at everything, called you every name under the sun, but it was for a reaction. But he put us into good places. And the best one he did with me, this is psychology as I knew it, sports psychology as I knew it at Sunderland. I had a bad ankle and I was having a fitness test to see if I could play a match against Middlesbrough. And I was in 3 hours before everybody else, and I went out on the pitch with the physio, and I did a bit of jogging, a bit of twisting, and then when it came to kicking the ball, it was still swollen and no good, so I had to call it a day. And I came in, and Peter Reid came in to me, and he said, "All right, look, son, get yourself ready for next week. Don't worry about it." And I said, "Thanks, Gaffer." And I was getting my suit back on, and Bobby Saxon came in, slammed the door, and said, so now we've got Billy Big Time here, starting believing all the newspapers." And I went, "Bob, I think that's unfair. I'm injured here." And he went, "Oh, no, you've gone big time now. I knew you when you were a proper player. You wouldn't even tell anyone if you had a bad ankle. But now you're believing all that shit in the papers. You're turning into one of them." So I got really upset and annoyed. It was, "How dare you?" You know, and he said, "What do you mean, how dare you?" And he actually pushed me. And I went, "You're bang out of order, Bobby. I can't even kick it." And he went, "When did we ever ask you to kick it?" "Said, just stand between the two 18-yard lines, stay in the middle of the pitch, we'll hit the effing ball to you, and just effing head it. And you better turn out and play for us today." And I went, "Jesus, I will." Something came in me and went, he got to me, so I'll play. Anyway, we won 1-0 and I scored a header. So that's the sports psychology I was used to.
You know, I went to psychology on the halfway line in Korea. There you are. Just put it between the balls, lads.
So you know, I think Roy, you know, belongs in that world. And I'd say it's probably tough for him now, you know, to see players, you know, the discipline is not even allowed to be challenged as he would like to, I would think.
And is it true he resigned by text message?
Well, so what had happened, I'd gone over to Portugal to look at a potential training ground for us for the summer. So I got all those nice jobs. And before I got on the flight, everything was fine. And when I got off the flight, he had resigned. But obviously he couldn't get hold of me, so he just sent a message. That's how that worked. But yeah.
Speaking of Portugal, you were likened to Cristiano Ronaldo a few years ago. Do you remember that? Do you remember the statue?
Yeah,
and Quinn's men rather than the Ronaldos.
I know, that was funny. And you know something, I thought, that's out of order. Imagine, and then I looked and I went, "Oh my God, it is." You know, I think somebody gave him the wrong photograph. But yeah, that was a bit of crack, really. Yeah, so nice to be finally mentioned with a superstar like that. You know,
well, there you go. Yeah, they just said, yeah, exactly. It should have been a statue of you anyway. But going back to your club career, it must have been. Was it gutting at that stage when you didn't get a medal at Arsenal at 89? Was that? Did you think you should have got one, or would you get one? You probably get one these days, would you?
You get one these days, but the chairman gave me a silver tray, and that was really nice of him. And JVC, who are our sponsors, gave me a CD player.
All right, wear the silver tray around your neck or anything? Or?
Yeah, no. I still have it there somewhere. It's in a box somewhere, but
treasured possession.
Yeah, treasured possession. No, not quite, because. I sat there at the do. We had this big do. They invited 1,000 fans to the Dorchester Hotel for the presentation of the medals to the players who had won the title. And it was a big, big event. And as the names were being called out for a medal, one of our players who hadn't played enough games, but it was coming out of contract and they wanted to sign a new contract, was called up for his medal. So I thought, that's great. If he's got one, I'll get one. And my name didn't get called out. But I then, later on in the night, the chairman came over to our table and rather than call me up on stage, he handed me this this silver tray. And Mr. Hillwood, he was ever so old Etonian, he went, "Young man, delighted that you gave an impact. You know, it was great. What position did you play?" You know. So I was just like, "Oh, okay. You know, thanks very much. Yeah, okay, I didn't get a medal. You're grand." And then the JVC, whatever it was, DVD player, and it wasn't even DVD, CD player in them days, I just got the two of them and left and went home on the N29. They had the night buses then. That's how much they were paying me at the time. I couldn't afford a taxi home. I wasn't in the team, so I wasn't getting bonuses, what have you, and appearance money. But so I got the N29 bus home, and I thought several times of just chucking it. And, the fact of the matter was I was gone very soon afterwards anyway. I went to City. But it's just I never really felt an Arsenal player after that night. Even though I'd been there 6 years, I played 90-odd games for them. I'd scored 20 goals, I think. And it's a part of my career that it was a great learning curve. And to be at Arsenal, to get the breaks I did under Don Howe initially, and George Graham for the first 18 months, I was in the team all the time. But then to be the number two, I'm sure, Ruby, in your world, there's been a number two who's looked on and just maybe eventually cracks and says, right, I got to go somewhere else. And
yeah, there is. Of course there is. It's in every sport. It's somewhere along the way you think, fuck this, I want to go and get my chance somewhere else.
Exactly. And I think that's exactly, I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly what I said on the bus that night.
Yeah.
I said, I'm off now. And I did everything I could to leave. And eventually, you know, because they used to have, the windows used to close in March in those days. You could go all year round. And I got in literally on the last day at 5 o'clock. So I went up to Man City and my career changed. So as good as it was, you know, the early days, it was a tough station for 3 years. Alan Smith was brilliant, and I'm not giving out about it. Alan Smith came and was superb, one of the great centre forwards Arsenal have had. But he never got injured and he never got booked. So, and we didn't have seven, you didn't have seven subs like you have now. You had two at the most, one when I started and then two. So it was just difficult. But I'll always be grateful to Arsenal for giving me the break, that's for sure. But I was glad to get out of there.
One thing that always I'm curious about, and it intrigues me because I know that all the agents are involved these days. I mean, you were saying there, okay, you're trying to get out of Arsenal to go to City because you're not getting the games, whatever. But how do you go about getting out of Arsenal and going to City? Do you employ an agent, or do you go to Arsenal and say, I want to leave, or what happens?
No, so we didn't have agents as such. Those days, they were only barely coming in, and only the top players seemed to have one. And what happened, they were the kind of agents that were bringing them up to the West End and bringing them to Stringfellas. And, you know, it was the agents with the big cigars and the champagne. So it wasn't the industry that we know today. And I kind of did my own thing. But in the end, I wrote a letter. Ken Fryer was the club secretary at the time. And I wrote a letter to Ken Fryer and saying, you know, I have to go. And they just came back and said, we've considered your request, but no, you're not going. So that was as far as I got. And you know, it wasn't like you could go storming in and take on the hierarchy. You were, if you did go in and see George Graham, you know, he would be sitting in this old library of an office that was there for over 100 years. And he'd be sitting in this big desk, like a judge looking down at you. And you're sitting on a little three-legged stool looking up at him. And, he, you know, it was a big ordeal for someone like myself who'd never done anything like that in my life before. You know, grew up, played football, went to Arsenal, everything's great. Now suddenly you're in trying to fight for your future. And, you know, and I had to kind of, you know, build up the courage to go in and take him on. So it wasn't easy because you didn't have an agent to do it. And I can remember Bobby Saxton used to tell a brilliant story about, you know, when Brian Clough became manager of Derby County at a young age, he was almost the same age as Bobby, and Bobby had to go in and see him. And he told his wife he was going in to see him, you know, and he came home and the wife went, how'd you get on? And he went, I'm definitely going to do it tomorrow. He just couldn't, you know, and that's kind of what the power they had was like. You know, they just had this power between them, managers and the clubs. You never even got, you know, that was the first time, you know, after 6 years that I met the chairman and that he spoke to me, didn't really know what position I played. It was just a different, it was old school, it was different. And eventually, March the 15th, 1990, we had the day off and we trained hard on the Tuesday. We were all given Wednesday off. I went golfing and I came home late on the Wednesday night, very late. And do you remember the old answer machines that would have a little digital number, the amount of calls that you missed?
Yeah.
You'd twist it. Well, if I got one, it was a miracle. But there was about six, and I went, oh, my God, I have a right few pints of me and somebody's dead at home. That was my first thought. And I turned the message one, and it was Howard Kendall here. I've just agreed a fee with Arsenal for you. I'd like to talk to you. Give me a ring. Message two. My heart was pounding. Message two. It's Howard Kendall here. You're obviously out late. Give us a message three. Howard Kendall here. Please ring me. Don't be afraid to ring me whatever time you get in. And there was one about 2 a.m, time to 2. And it went, it's Howard Kendall here. And he was jarred. And he went, I think you and I are going to get along really well. and I went up, flew up to Manchester the next day and signed for Man City.
So never looked back. Are you still the only person to have scored a goal and saved a penalty in the one game? Poor old Dean Saunders missed against you.
Yeah, and maybe in the UK, maybe in the Premier League I am, but I think it happened in Spain. I think a fella saved two one day, got in goal and saved two penalties, but maybe in the German League or somewhere like that. But that was funny. You know, before online social media, the way they picked the player of the year was they'd leave a docket on every seat and they'd leave them on the terraces for people to vote at one game near the end of the season. And that was the last home game. And that was the one that I picked to do that thing and save a penalty. I'm sure everybody just put my name down as player of the year because I'd saved the penalty and scored a goal. And the poor, like, David White had the best year of all that year. He scored 20-odd goals. He was magnificent. But I got player of the year for, like, 2 minutes' work, you know.
Did you ever rib Dean Saunders about it?
I did a few times, yeah, because he came up the next season for Liverpool and he hit the bar against a normal goalkeeper as well. So that was good fun.
With City today, is it a bit like Del Boy becoming a millionaire? Like, it's great to have all that money, but not the same crack as when you haven't got a pot to piss in kind of thing, like, you know?
That's a fair question. What Man City would I prefer to have played for? Believe it or not, I'm really glad I played at the Man City I did. The Kitbacks was the toughest set of fans to please because they had all of one side and behind one goal. It was an incredible, it wasn't a stand, it was in the old days, but they took it out and made it a terrace the whole way around before All-Seater Stadium came in. And if you pleased them in the Kitbacks, you were doing some, you know, and they didn't suffer fools. And I won them over. And it was a really great time in my life because I was becoming a player. I was showing what I was made of. I got 20 goals one year. I think I was the last City player before Tevez to get 20 top flight goals in a season. So, you know, times were good. Now, it wasn't what it is today. And, you know, it's kind of Hollywood today, but in our days it was great. And this local group started to become superstars at the time. And they would go on stage all over the country and they'd wear my shirt number with my name. You know, Oasis used to do stuff like that. And, you know, suddenly you're getting ideas about yourself and I've been asked to do Question of Sport. And, you know, you suddenly think, Jesus, I've arrived, you know. And then I got married and that life kind of slowed down a little bit then. But it was a time when I actually burst out of my shell in many ways at Man City and I loved it. And we had great fun. Peter Reid, again, got the best out of me in those days, Howard Kendall initially. And he always used to say to me, you know, if the players are going out, you mind them. Stay together and you mind them. So I was kind of the fella that almost had a license to go out once I got everybody home safe. And, you know, I was good at it. I got very good at it. And we had some eventful nights and we had some crack, but that was it. There was no mobile phones then, you know. To Peter Reid to see on his phone instantly is, you know, you couldn't have lived the life we led in those days if there was mobile phones. And that's not to say we were really bad. It was just, you know, life was different. And in some respects, if you went into a pub, a few lads, a few of the players, the locals would be thrilled to see you. Oh, fair play. Thanks for coming in. You know, you aren't stuck up like the United lot. They don't go anywhere. They were afraid of their lives at Fergie, you know. And we were able to go off and do our bit, and a little bit under the radar, if you like. And I loved it. I loved what the club meant. You know, very sad week this week to hear Colin Bell's passing. But, you know, Colin was a coach in my time there. He was coaching the young players. And he would always, you know, talk to you about what the club meant and what its traditions were and what it stood for. Tony Book, who's still going strong, great Man City servant. Glyn Pardo, who passed away. These were people who, you know, were the backbone of the club. And are recognised brilliantly, and until they died, we're recognised brilliantly. And Tony Book is too by the current regime. You know, they are, you know, fixtures and fittings in the stadium there now, and rightly so. And I learned a lot, you know, from that, from the guys who were successful at a club, the guys who had won European competitions, the guys who had won FA Cups, the guys who had won the league. And when that club was in full flow in the 60s and early 70s, you know, the team they had, Franny Lee, Colin Bell, Summerby, you know, Mike Doyle, Joe Cardigan, they're legends of the game. Colin Bell probably being the best of them. To follow that and not do well was the only downside because, you know, we finished fifth twice in those days in what we now know as the Premier League. But Man United had started to roar. Fergie was starting to win things. And that made it, fifth was nothing. Fifth was 15th. And I always have a regret that we didn't get to a cup final or we didn't do something with that group of players that we had because we weren't far off. You know, we were probably a striker like Robbie Keane or a Kevin Phillips who come up to Sunderland. We were probably a 20-goal-a-man season away from maybe certainly getting into Europe and pushing in cup competitions. But it was nothing like today. I really admire what's happened today. I'm delighted for the fans. They've got a break. They've caught a break after years and years of doom and gloom. And so you know, I think for them, I think it's better what's happened now, obviously. And I love some of the players over the years, from Yaya Toure, you know, you could go right through company. We could name loads of them here. Silva, you know, delight to watch week in, week out. So it's been brilliant. And listen, Chelsea, when they started it, when they got all the money in, Blackburn, actually, I would say in my time, were the first. Mr. Walker, the chairman there.
Alan Shearer. Jesus. Alan Shearer,
yeah.
Break me heart to United fan to mention that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, Ruby. Yeah, you know, when you look back, what would United have been with him in full flow? You know, but he did it the other way. He went to Blackburn, won the title with Blackburn, and you know, there were other, obviously Chelsea then started spending and doing what they did. The world started to change, and now of course it's in fifth gear, where it is incredible the amount of money that's in the game. They've really maximised the TV incomes. Players are earning absolutely multiples of what we earn, but I promise you, they don't have nowhere near as much fun as we did. It doesn't even register on the scale.
Maybe it was you who started it all, Niall. Because most people, when they love a club, like, they'll kiss the badge and all that. You went and bought the bloody thing with Sunderland. what was it about Sunderland that made you love them so much? Because you went from City to Sunderland, and it was kind of, you've said before, I've read that just like they really got under, their club got under your skin, and it just, I don't know, that was a real connection, wasn't it?
It was, and it didn't start that way, because I got injured very quickly to my other cruciate, and I was brought in to, you know, be the one that made them stay in the Premier League. And I got injured after four or five matches. So it was a disaster. And I tried to come back too soon, and it wasn't happening for me. And I was getting dogs abuse. Family, Gillian, you know, saying, what are we doing here? Like, you know, why did we leave Manchester for here? And it was a tough time. And anyway, I grafted away at it, and I got a break. I got a great operation eventually on my knee, and things started to look better for me. And then Kevin Phillips walked through the door as well, unnoticed almost. You know, it was one of those signings that didn't even get a headline. And things started to click for me. And I think the fans appreciated the work that I was putting in, because they knew the easiest thing to do would be to take the retirement money and play golf. But the hardest thing to do was to come back and show and prove to them that I could be a force and play a major role in a better time for the club. And with Kevin Phillips scoring the goals the way he scored the goals, I was getting credited for some. I wasn't even playing some of the matches. They were giving me credit for the goals that he got. But it just gave me a new lease of life. And with that, I appreciated a really hard-working area, what the football club meant to them, and how important it was that we gave maximum effort for them, but that we were with them, and that they, you know, we made them feel as if we were sort of acting on their behalf and showing, I suppose, a pride in how we played and believing in ourselves to give them a lift. Because, you know, the shipbuilding had finished, the coal mines had been closed. It was poor there for a long time in the Northeast. But lo and behold, as we started doing this on the football side, Newcastle started doing it, Middlesbrough started doing it, it started to come good. Nissan were providing thousands of jobs. New industry was coming. Tony Blair was a local around the corner from where we were. He was our local MP. You know, he was bringing sort of all sorts of business to the area. And so there was a buzz around the Northeast. And we kind of caught a lift on that. As a family, Gillian and I, it was a wonderful time in our lives. Our children were born there. And we kind of felt, you know, even like Newcastle Falcons were the best rugby team. They were winning the ice hockey, Newcastle, the best ice hockey team, and that was on TV up there. So there was a great buzz, and people like Ruud Hullett were coming, you know, to manage Newcastle. And it was just a great time to be playing football in the Northeast. And I appreciated that, because, as I said to many people, they're just like Dubs. You know, they're like the way the Dublin fans follow Dublin Gaelic football. They live for it. They love it. And they don't, you know, they're not as successful as Dublin, obviously, but they're the nearest thing to what I would call, you know, Irish diehard fans, in that the club is everything. They can be quite tough if you're not putting it in, but if you put it in for them, they were great. And so that relationship just grew and grew.
Yeah. That's where you went with Sunderland, and you repaid them. But you did pretty much the same for Irish soccer as well. I mean, you took the role as interim deputy CEO of the FAI. How did that come about?
Well, I had been quite vocal in the media about the need for change. And then everything unfurled quite quickly in the regime of John Delaney coming to an end. And it was obviously in a very poor place, football at that point, and facing potential bankruptcy. I mean, everybody knows that, and it needed a government bailout. But the government wanted some proof that things would change in there. And so when they went about doing what they did, I was called upon and interviewed for a few different theories and questions. And then it fell away for a few months. And then eventually, when Roy Barrett came in, he appointed Gary Owens. And between the two of them, they got in touch with me and asked to come in and give them a hand, that they needed some help on the football side. And, you know, I knew, I said, look, they said it's 6 months. There is a job to be done here in effectively changing on the governance side, that there's financial governance, that there's electoral governance, and on the playing side, that we can somehow, you know, get everything back onto an even keel. And 6 months was never going to do it. But what was important was that we did enough in that 6 months to allow for a government rescue to take place, because everybody says they gave us a bailout last January. They didn't. We had to do an awful lot before the first money came in. It was actually August by the time any new money came in at all after that announcement. And in those 6 months, we had a lot of work to do behind the scenes. And listen, Ruby, absolutely. You know, what I would say, and what I talk about, you know, everybody I knew got in touch with me and said, what are you doing? It's madness in there. Don't go in there. And it just felt, no, I'd done a lot of talking about it. So it was time to go in and see if we could help in some way. But I was pleasantly surprised by the talent that's in there. Now, the other thing was, there was jobs at risk. You know, there's a lot of jobs at risk. Young people who'd kind of given up other ways of life to be in the world of football, maybe not as paid as highly as they might be if they're doing the same job in the financial services or whatever. But there was 200 people between, you know, all full-time staff. And you just say, okay, we'll see if we can put it together that we don't actually have to have job losses, and can the government trust us enough to do that? So there was a big play there to try and get things right and get people to buy into it. But obviously, and you can see why some people weren't enamored with our presence there, and that's fine. You know, you kind of get that. They've put a lot of effort in over the years in football, and I fully got why some of them were you know, put out by the fact that we were ushered in to save the day. So that there's unhealthy in some ways, but small and minimal in terms of the overview of it all. And when I look back at the 6-7 months that I spent there, was the people who went in first were never going to be the ones to carry it on. The 6 months was all it was meant to be, and hopefully, you know, you'd done enough to clear it in such a way that
future for the FAI.
Yeah, that you've cleared that the new guy coming in can bring the sides together, because there is, you know, a sort of self-interest between various elements of football in this country. You know, women's football are trying desperately now to get their game up and running in a better way. Schoolboys Association are saying, we're getting a raw deal, we need more. The League of Ireland, of course, you know, that's long since held, you know, a real grudge against the way it's been treated. So you have a kind of a number of areas, you know, really fighting for everything they possibly can. And truthfully, if I was to answer the question, maybe it needs more money.
Would there have been any argument to wind it down, wipe the slate clean, and start again?
Well, it's a centenary year, 100 years, and you think, you know, is it all to be just thrown away? I think there's a nostalgia point there to look at. Can it be kept? And I'm out of it now, so I've no idea what way policy will go in time. I think, the new man has a huge job. Jonathan Hill has a huge job. He's got a lot of unhappy parts of the association, and he can do a lot of talking, I suppose, but without money and without being able to bring and make healthy all of these different parts, it's going to be very difficult. I think the way the game was kind of treated and the pain that it's gone through, you know, I think we all have to look at it and say, okay, is it time now to think differently? And even the groups, you know, that feel hard done by, that have this grudge, and look, people say they rightly have it, you know, can it be put to one side now? Can you start a new development? Does that mean changing the name of the association? I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But But I do think the effort has been made now to bring a governance in place that allows the baby steps, if you like, that allows a better future to come about and more confidence. Now, we're caught in the, I suppose, in the aftershock of the Laney era, and trying to bring in this sort of new way of governance so quickly, there are people put out with that, but hopefully it will settle down and hopefully everybody will get a fair deal in this and that the game will
move
start.
On, as they say.
Move on. Yeah, you're right. It's kind of caught a little bit. I'd agree with that.
Are you surprised Damien Duff walked away?
Yeah, I haven't spoken to Damien, and I haven't spoken to Alan Kelly. I'm surprised, yeah. But, you know, I would, my first thought on that, and I don't know right or wrong how this is, but, you know, if you're not happy in what you're doing, where you're going at, you're right to walk away.
You know? I agree with there.
Yeah, you're dead right to walk away.
Wholeheartedly. If you're not happy, get out.
Correct.
I'm not dragging sure everyone else with you.
I'm not sure you've ever had such a grown-up conversation on From the Horse's Mouth, but geez.
Did we lose you, Paddy, yeah?
Look, everybody wants Irish football to do well, guys, you know, and there is real problems underneath the tin, and, you know, they're boiling up all the time, and hopefully in some shape or form, a window of opportunity from government to go further. Okay, the rescue package is most welcome, and that settles the thing down. But I would hope that, you know, as the next election comes around, that football will be on the potential TD's lists of, you know, things to do and try and say, okay, can we kick on? Because it is an important sport. It is important, the numbers playing each week. We're all looking for something to aspire to. We want everything to be better. And personally, until we have our own 5-star academy up in Abbottstown with all of the best players being treated the way all the players their ages are in the countries like Spain, Italy, England, etc., we're always going to have problems at the elite level and right the way down to the grassroots.
That's the answer we wanted in the beginning.
Fair enough.
Well, okay. Just as simple as that. Like.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. There you go. Thanks, Ruby. Am I being paid by the word here? No.
Not quite.
Listen, you've been very good with your time. We are in the final furlong now, so don't worry. But I just want to ask you quickly about the GAA, because you had that swan song in playing Gaff after your retirement and everything. That GAA was something close to your heart as well.
Well, we were a GAA family. My dad hurled for Tipperary before he emigrated to England at a young age. He came back and hurled for Dublin for a bit, and he dragged us, girls and all, to all matches all over the country. You know, if there was a club hurling match in Wexford, we were dragged down to see it, you know, as youngsters. And we were brought up in that way, and hurling was my first sport. You know, I was playing on the under-12 team when I was about 6. Robert Emmett's my local club. And the soccer came along, like, The ban was in until 71, I think. You know, I was born in 66, but it still was in a way. You know, in our house, my mother said, look, okay, a man called here to see, would you play in the soccer leagues? And we let you go up, but don't tell your dad. You know, it was that kind of existence. That's how staunch the era. But once my dad found out, he didn't care. He was delighted to see me playing, really. Although it took me a couple of years to tell him. And then I managed to do both. I played all sports and, you know, kind of got good at two or three of them. And eventually then I had the choice. I could go to Australia to play Aussie Rules. I could go to Arsenal to play football, or I could stay in Dublin and try and hurl with the Dublin team and work my way through employment in Dublin. So obviously as a young lad, the bright lights of London and Arsenal, they grabbed the most attention.
Leeds Town, till your heart, till you came back to Kildare when you retired and you won a Junior C county title with Eads Town in Kildare. That's a fair honour for a dub.
Yeah, not many dubs probably have come down and done that, but it was a wonderful time because I thought about coming home and playing out League of Ireland, and then I thought, you know, I've been through that and actually nobody asked me, so that was another reason I didn't do it. So I kind of went up. Father Breen, who you remember well.
Yeah.
Father Breen went up.
So I see where all these connections are coming from Sunderland. Father Breen, Eads Town, Sean Mulrain. I can see where it's all just starting to evolve here.
That's how it happened. And we went up to Mass shortly after coming home. The family, it was Easter Sunday. And he just very said, would you ever come down to the Gaa lads on Tuesday night? They got a match. They'd love to see you. You know, the Junior Bs. Or he told me they were Junior B. If he'd have said Junior C, I'm not so sure I'd have gone. But I said, yeah, sure, I'll go. And turning up then on the Tuesday night, I brought Mikey up. And you know that road up to Eastown, up to the double parking the whole way up. I was there going, what's going on here, you know? And eventually got up to the top and lovely man on the Pat Doyle on the gate with a plastic bucket, you know, €5. So I kind of said to him, I'm playing actually. And he went, you won't be playing if you don't put €5 in here. Like, you know, so that was my welcome. And big crowd had turned out. And what had done, the Breener called all the newspapers and radios and announced that I was coming and that they could see me playing Gaelic for €5. And when I went into the dressing room, half the lads, you know, you must remember this wasn't long after Saipan, half the lads in my own team were Roy Keane fans. I could tell straight away they weren't impressed at all. And so it was a little bit tricky. And in the end, they put me on the subs bench, but it wasn't a bench, the subs ditch. And with 10 minutes to go, they brought me on and I scored a point and we won. But there's a story that got his legs. But the next match I played, there was again a bit of a crowd at the next match, but we played against Salons and I got 3 penalties. And I scored the 3 penalties. And on the third one, I'll never forget it, their umpire, because, you know, each fella, you'd have an umpire, and he threw the white flag down at me and went, "Get up, you diving bastard, and feck off back to England." And a bit of a row started, right? So the row started. And I sure I didn't want to be fighting anyway. I was only having a bit of crack. And anyway, the whole thing kind of quieted down. We walked off the pitch, and that's when I kind of went over to the goalkeeper, who was a young lad, the Salons keeper, and I said, "Jesus, hard luck there. I'd say you'd have loved to have saved one of those penalties." And in beautiful Salons brogue, which I can't do that well, he went, "Piss off, you prick. You wouldn't take one against Spain." So that was my welcome home. Treasure sportsman, my yard.
Welcome to Junior C football in Kildare.
There you have it.
Jesus Christ.
Well, listen, Niall, you've been really good with your time. Really appreciate it. Now, there is one more task for you. I know you're a racing fan. Would you say you prefer jumps or flat?
I had flat horses because I was afraid of jumped horses getting injured. And Jim Bulger, you know, was probably the first trainer that I knew. So I ended up there. But I love the spectacle of jumps. And I've only missed Cheltenham for the last 2 years out of maybe the last 27.
Well, that's grand, because normally at the end of the show, what we'll do is we'll offer you a chance to take the jumps questions or the flat questions. The flat ones are easier. We've just got 3 questions for you, okay. But we're going to give you the jumps anyway.
Great, perfect. Suits me.
So, Ruby, away with you.
I'll go first. What's the worst decision you ever made in football?
Not signing for Sporting Lisbon. Carlos Queiroz was the coach there who later came to Man United and did great things, and he agreed to be with Man City, and I went over. Signed for them, picked a house to live, moving the family over, had a row with Man City over the departing fee, and he gave me 7 days, and when I didn't clear it up after 7 days, he went for somebody else. That's the one I look back and say, I wish I'd have done.
Oh, interesting. How much further could you have gone in the 2002 World Cup at Roy Keane?
Great question. With a...
diplomatic answer.
No, I won't. I think with a strong, determined Roy Keane as part of the force and leading us. I think we might have clicked a little bit further. As I said, I would have loved a crack at the Koreans in the next round. And so there is regret there. So, yeah, I would say it's possible, although, you know, you can't get away with the argument that maybe some of us also overperformed out of sheer necessity to do well because he was gone.
Patrick?
Finally, he gives me the real serious one. Could you still fit into your disco pants?
Absolutely not. So we just did a clear out the other day of jeans that don't fit anymore. And they're only about 3 years old. So there's no way the disco pants are going to go. But I had to throw out 6 lovely pairs of jeans. But I didn't throw them out. Gillian brought them somewhere, Vincent the Fall or something. So hopefully they find some. If you see some well-dressed 6'5" fella floating around with some jeans. I kind of the waist is getting bigger all the time. I suppose that's the way I tell you.
In a sense, that clear out's coming to me on wardrobe too. Niall Quinn, thanks a million.
Thanks, cheers, Niall. Cheers.
Really enjoyed it.
Righto, that's all we've got time for on today's show. My thanks to Paddy and Ruby and our special guest, Mr. Niall Quinn. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. Make sure you're subscribed to the show. We're back on Friday with a tipping edition, and on Wednesday we'll be rolling out a whole new series building up to a very, very special Cheltenham Festival. Between now and then, I've been Tom Nugent, and that was From the Horse's Mouth.